Okay, so our mission today really is to dive into this fascinating scientific mismatch between, well, how companies try to motivate you and what the science actually says works. We're digging deep into Daniel Pink's work on what drives us. Because for ages, the standard operating system at work, let's call it Motivation 2.0, it's all been built on this one idea that people are basically just out to maximize wealth. You know?
Yeah, the rational actor's idea.
Exactly. So you dangle a carrot, some bonus, or you threaten with a stick like getting fired, and people should just, follow the money, predictably.
But the huge problem there, and this is really the core issue, is that this whole system, it just doesn't fit with how work actually is now in the 21st century.
No.
Well, think about it. So much work today is more conceptual, right? It's heuristic. It's not just following a set procedure like on an assembly line.
Right, you have to figure things out, be creative.
Precisely. And Motivation 2.0, that old carrot and stick model, it completely misses this crucial third drive that humans have. It just ignores it.
Okay, so that's what we're exploring. This deep dive has kind of three parts. First, we'll look at the science, like where did this idea of a third drive even come from? Some surprising stuff there.
Wait, wait, wait.
Then we'll break down why the old reward system, Motivation 2.0, often fails, sometimes spectacularly.
And then we get to the good stuff.
Yeah, the upgrade. Motivation 3.0 will lay out the three key nutrients you need for what Pink calls type I behavior: autonomy, mastery, and purpose.
Sounds like a plan.
Uh-huh.
So let's start with that science, because it really began with something, well, unexpected. We have to talk about Harry Harlow and his monkeys back in, what, 1949?
Oh, I love this study. It's just so not what you'd expect. Harlow had these eight rhesus monkeys, right? And a simple little puzzle.
Yeah, a mechanical puzzle. Pull a pin, undo a hook, lift a little lid. Simple steps.
And the original plan wasn't even about motivation. He just wanted the monkeys to get used to the puzzle before he started testing them with rewards like food.
Right, just familiarization. But then the weird thing happened.
The monkeys just started playing with the puzzles without any prompting.
Exactly. They didn't just play, they got focused, determined. Harlow's notes even said they looked like they were, well, enjoying it, and they solved the puzzles again and again.
With zero reward, no food, no praise, nothing, just the task itself.
That was the first real hint of this powerful third drive, something beyond just biological needs or external rewards. But then Harlow did what seemed logical next.
He introduced a reward, raisins, I think.
Yep, raisins for solving the puzzle. And according to Motivation 2.0 logic, performance should have soared, right?
You'd think. Get a treat, solve more puzzles.
But it didn't happen. Performance actually got worse. Introducing the raisin, the extrinsic reward, it messed things up. They solved it less often, seemed less interested.
Wait, so the reward hurt performance. How does that even work?
It's about how the reward changes your perception of the task. When the monkey solved it for fun, the puzzle was the reward.
Yeah.
The activity itself was the point. But introduce the raisin, and suddenly the goal isn't solve the puzzle, it's get the raisin. The puzzle becomes just, work you have to do to get the treat. It reframes the whole thing.
Ah, I see. It shifts the focus from the inherent enjoyment to the external prize.
Precisely. Harlow didn't pursue it much further, but fast forward 20 years, 1969. Edward Deci picks up this thread. He wants to know, does this happen with humans too?
And he used that Soma puzzle, right? The seven block pieces.
That's the one. With university students, he had two groups, Group A and Group B, three sessions.
Okay, lay it out.
Session one, both groups just play with the puzzle. Session two, Group A gets paid a dollar, which was decent money then, for each puzzle they solve. Group B, the control, gets nothing.
So Group A gets the extrinsic reward.
Right. But the key part was session three. In the middle of that session, Deci leaves them alone for 8 minutes, supposedly a break. He secretly watches what they do. There are magazines on the table, and the puzzle is still there. No one is getting paid now.
Ah, the free choice period. What would they choose to do when the reward was gone?
And the result was striking. Group A, the ones who'd been paid, they spent way less time playing with the puzzle in that free period compared to how much they played back in session one before money was involved.
Wow. So paying them actually made them less interested in the puzzle itself later on.
Significantly less. They basically lost their intrinsic interest once money entered the picture. It confirmed Harlow's finding, but in humans. Extrinsic rewards can crowd out, can extinguish intrinsic motivation.
That's huge. It fundamentally undermines the whole carrot approach of Motivation 2.0, especially for interesting tasks.
It really does. And you see the fallout of relying on that old model everywhere in the modern world. especially where creativity or voluntary effort is involved.
Like the Wikipedia example, that's a killer one.
Absolute perfect example. Think back to the mid-90s. Microsoft pours millions into Encarta, paid professionals, editors, managers, pure motivation 2.0.
Right, the standard corporate model.
And then there's this crazy idea called Wikipedia, run by, what, tens of thousands of unpaid volunteers, anonymous people just contributing for free?
In 1996, if you told an economist Wikipedia would crush Encarta, they'd have laughed you out of the room.
No question. But look what happened. Encarta's gone. Wikipedia is, well, Wikipedia, the dominant encyclopedia, constantly updated.
And it's not just Wikipedia, is it?
Not at all. The whole open source software movement runs on this.
Yep.
Linux, Firefox, Apache. The web server software that powers, like, half the internet's corporate sites, built mostly by people driven by intrinsic motivation.
What drives them, then, if not money?
The joy of the challenge. The satisfaction of solving a complex problem, of creating something elegant. The sheer fun of mastery. It's type I motivation in action.
This idea that rewards can spoil intrinsic fun, that's the Sawyer effect, right?
Yeah. Named after Tom Sawyer, tricking his friends into paying him to whitewash the fence. He turned a chore into something desirable. But the principle works in reverse, too. Rewards can turn play into work, make something fun feel like a drag.
Okay, but let's be fair. Carrots and sticks must work sometimes, right? Like, for really boring, repetitive tasks. If I'm just doing data entry, won't a bonus make me do it faster?
Yes, absolutely. For purely algorithmic tasks, where there's a clear set of steps, a formula to follow, no creativity needed, ex-physic rewards can work. They can focus attention and increase speed. Routine work, assembly lines, basic data entry. Sure.
So the distinction is crucial, algorithmic versus heuristic.
Exactly. The moment a task requires even rudimentary cognitive skill, creativity, problem solving, the moment it becomes heuristic, that's when rewards start to backfire, often badly.
And there's that classic experiment that shows this so clearly, the candle problem.
Dunker's candle problem. Brilliant demonstration. Simple setup. You're given a candle, a box of thumbtacks, and a book of matches. Your job. Attach the candle to the wall so wax doesn't drip on the table.
And the solution involves thinking outside the box. Literally.
Precisely. You have to overcome functional fixedness. You see the box holding the tacks, and you only seat it to the container. The trick is realizing you can empty the box, tack it to the wall, and place the candle on top, like a little shelf.
It requires that little spark of insight.
It does. Now, here's the kicker. Researchers ran this test, and for one group, they offered a pretty big cash reward for finishing quickly, like $5 or $20, which was significant money then.
So, motivation 2.0 in action, incentivized speed and ingenuity.
You'd think. But the results were stunning. The group offered the cash reward took, on average, almost 3.5 minutes longer to solve the problem than the group offered no reward at all.
Longer. You offer money for speed, and they get slower. That seems completely backward.
It does, until you understand why. Remember how rewards narrow focus?
Right. You mentioned that with the monkeys.
Well, for algorithmic tasks, narrow focus is good. Helps you execute the steps efficiently. But for the candle problem, you need the opposite. You need broad peripheral vision, cognitively speaking. You need to see the box not just as a container, but as a potential platform.
And the reward blocks that.
The promise of the reward creates this tunnel vision. It focuses you so intensely on the goal, get the money, that it actually prevents the kind of open creative thinking needed to find the solution. It literally makes you less insightful. For creative work, carrots can be actively damaging.
Okay, so that really hammers home the limitations, the dangers even, of motivation 2.0 for modern work. It's just not fit for purpose anymore.
Not for work that requires thinking, creativity, engagement. We need an upgrade. And that brings us to motivation 3.0, the new operating system.
Built on that third drive, the intrinsic motivation, type I behavior.
Exactly. And this system, this type I behavior, it thrives on three essential nutrients, as Pink calls them. Autonomy, mastery, and purpose.
Let's break those down. First up, autonomy. This is fundamental, isn't it? The urge to direct our own lives.
Deeply fundamental. We're not just passive responders to rewards. We're active agents who want control. And forward-thinking organizations get this. They grant autonomy over what Pink identifies as the four T's. Task, time, technique, and team.
Okay, task autonomy, like deciding what projects you work on.
Yeah, or at least having some say. Think about 3M's famous 15% time. or Google's 20% time. That wasn't just about being nice.
No, it was a strategic bet on employee ingenuity.
Right. Giving people dedicated time to work on projects they choose, projects they're intrinsically interested in. It signals trust, and it taps into that autonomous drive.
And the results are legendary. Post-it notes came out of 3M's 15% time. Gmail, Google News, lots of Google hits came from 20% time.
Because you're unleashing people's own drive and creativity, not just directing them top down. Okay, say tease time. Autonomy over when you work.
This sounds like ROWE, the results only work environment.
Exactly. Best Buy's corporate headquarters famously tried this. Productivity apparently jumped about 35%. The core idea is radical but simple. People can work whenever, wherever, as long as the work gets done.
So it shifts the focus from presence being seen at your desk to actual results.
Which is what should matter, right? It's about trusting people to manage their own time effectively, to meet clear goals. That freedom, that trust is incredibly motivating for many people.
Okay, task, time, technique, autonomy over how you do the work.
Yeah, micromanagement is the enemy here. Think about Zappos, the online shoe retailer, famous for customer service. They do something really interesting with rewards.
Oh, the pay to quit offer.
That's the one. After their intensive training, they offer new hires $2,000 to leave the company.
Seems crazy, right? Why pay people not to work for you?
Because it's a filter. It uses an extrinsic reward, the cash, to screen for intrinsic motivation. If you're just there for the paycheck, $2,000 to walk away looks pretty good.
Ah, so if you turn down the money, it signals you're genuinely committed to the job and the Zappos way.
Exactly. And the Zappos way demands high autonomy over technique. Their customer service reps don't use scripts. They don't have strict time limits on calls. They're trusted to do whatever it takes to make the customer happy, using their own judgment and personality. The $2,000 offer helps ensure they have people suited for that level of autonomy.
Clever. Okay, task, time, technique. Team is the last T. Choosing who you work with.
That one's maybe harder to implement everywhere, but the principle holds. Having some say in your collaborators fosters a greater sense of control and investment.
Right. Okay, so autonomy is crucial. What's the second nutrient? Mastery.
Mastery. This is the urge we all have to get better at things that matter to us, to improve our skills, to tackle challenges, to make progress.
This connects to that idea of flow, doesn't it? Miley Csikszentmihalyi's work.
Absolutely. Flow is that state of being completely absorbed in an activity. You're challenged but not overwhelmed. Your skills are fully utilized. Time disappears. You're in the zone.
The effort itself feels rewarding.
Yes, that's the hallmark of flow. And it happens most often with what Pink calls Goldilocks tasks. Not too hard, not too easy, just right. They stretch you, but they're achievable.
So for organizations wanting to foster mastery, they need to provide these Goldilocks tasks, opportunities to learn and grow.
Consistently. It's about enabling deliberate practice. Giving people tasks slightly beyond their current capabilities, providing clear feedback, allowing them to refine their skills. It's not always comfortable. Mastery involves struggle.
And mindset plays a big role here too, right? Carol Dweck's research.
Huge role. Dweck found people tend towards one of two mindsets. A fixed mindset believes abilities are innate, static traits. You're either good at something or you're not.
So you avoid challenges because failure would expose your limits.
Exactly. But a growth mindset believes abilities can be developed through dedication and hard work. These people embrace challenges, see effort as the path to mastery, learn from criticism.
So fostering a growth mindset culture is key for enabling mastery.
Absolutely essential. Mastery isn't a destination. It's a journey, an asymptote you approach but never quite reach. It requires persistence, grit, and that belief that effort makes a difference.
Okay, autonomy mastery. The third nutrient is purpose.
Purpose. This is the big one in many ways. It's the yearning to do what we do in the service of something larger than ourselves, to contribute, to make a difference.
We're seeing this more and more, aren't we? Companies emphasizing mission alongside profit, the rise of for-benefit organizations.
Definitely. Think about companies like Thomas Shoes, Buy a Pair, Give a Pair. They built their whole brand around purpose. It attracts employees and customers who want to be part of something meaningful, not just a commercial transaction. People are increasingly purpose maximizers, not just profit maximizers.
How does this manifest inside an organization? Is it just about having a lofty mission statement?
That's part of it, but it has to be authentic, lived. Robert Reich, the former labor secretary, had a simple test, the pronoun test.
The pronoun test.
Yeah. When employees talk about the company, do they say they? As in, they decided to. That usually signals distance, disengagement.
Versus saying we.
Exactly. We launched a new project we believe in.
Hmm.
Saying we suggests identification, shared purpose, a sense of belonging. It's a small linguistic clue, but often very telling about the culture.
That makes sense. And embedding purpose can have real tangible benefits, too. I remember reading about a Mayo Clinic study.
Oh, yeah, that's a powerful one. They found that doctors who are allowed to spend just one day a week focusing on the part of their job, they found most meaningful, maybe it was research, maybe mentoring students, maybe specific patient interactions.
Whatever connected them to their deeper purpose.
Right. Those doctors had half the burnout rate compared to their colleagues who didn't have that dedicated purpose time.
Half the burnout, just from dedicating, what, 20% of their time to purpose-driven work? That's incredible.
It really is. It shows a purpose isn't just fluff. It's like a renewable energy source for motivation. When you feel your work matters, contributes to something bigger, it helps you push through the difficult parts, the inevitable frustrations. The why fuels the how.
Okay, so wrapping this up. We've journeyed from the old world, Motivation 2.0, with its carrots and sticks that we now know can actually crush creativity and kill interest.
Especially for the kind of work most of us do today.
To this necessary upgrade, Motivation 3.0, an operating system built on our innate, intrinsic drives, fueled by providing autonomy, opportunities for mastery, and a connection to purpose. Understanding this shift is, frankly, essential for anyone navigating the modern world of work.
And maybe even life in general. There's a sobering final thought here, linked back to Dacey and his colleagues' research. They tracked college grads over time, looking at their goals.
What did they find?
They found that the graduates who pursued primarily extrinsic goals, becoming wealthy, achieving fame, cultivating an image, even the ones who succeeded spectacularly in achieving those goals.
They must have been happier, right? They got what they wanted.
You'd think so. But they reported no higher levels of life satisfaction than when they started. And worse, many of them actually showed an increase in negative indicators, like anxiety and depression.
Wow. So they won the Motivation 2.0 game, got the big carrots, and it didn't actually fulfill them. It might have even made things worse.
It suggests chasing external validation doesn't lead to internal well-being.
That leaves us with a pretty powerful question for you, the listener. You've heard the science now. When you think about your own goals, whether it's at work or just in life, what are you really chasing and why? Is it the profit, the external markers, or is it purpose, mastery, autonomy? If you hit that goal you're aiming for tomorrow, would it truly deliver what you need? Something to think about.